Well, how have you been, Mark?
I'm well, yeah. So the book's been out about a month or so.
Yeah.
And I haven't had any unexpected reviews. I was hoping to get a few reviews like in the Christian press in this country. I think they might be coming. So I'm still waiting on that a bit, but getting a nice little crop of emails from people who have read it and said, this really got something for me. I want to take it further. So that sort of sense that it might get momentum, as it were, and not just be, oh, that was an interesting read, and then move on, because that's kind of what you want for a book, if possible.
Well, what would you like the book to do?
I think give people a fresh sense of Christianity, and particularly the person of Jesus, and focus people on this transformation of consciousness, which I think is at the heart of Christianity. What would traditionally be called the mystical side. I don't know, relocating the kind of spiritual wellspring of our culture. I feel that we need it as a culture, even if as a civilization. And Barfield, I think, can help point us at that. And also move Christianity, I think, from, I don't know how you see it, but for me, it feels in this country it's got a predominantly kind of moral sensibility, which is no bad thing. But move it from that to a sensibility which is much more about the mystical core of life itself, which actually I think is much, much more needed in Western culture. I think we've got very uncoupled from that.
It's interesting. I've never been to the UK, but I've obviously spoken with some people from it, and I know some people who live there. It's always so hard to talk about these things with any clarity, because we're all individuals and we sense the culture from our own perspective and from our own little locus of consciousness. But the sense that I often get from the UK is that obviously there's the state church, the Anglican Church. There's some of these fringe Christian movements that are a little bit evangelical-ish, let's say. Some brought over from America, and some that have always sort of been native to the UK, and but yet a vast realm of people who are sort of living in the shadow of old churches, but for whom any kind of conscious connection with the Christian tradition is fairly detached. Is that fair?
Yeah, no, I think it is. I mean, it's the percentage of people that go to church is very low now. I think Anglican Christianity is still fairly significant in the culture. Still quite a lot of people will get married in a church. They'll think about something like baptism, funerals, that kind of thing. And of course, when a new monarch gets crowned or something like that, then the church swings right into action, But I think in terms of it really being a resource that people might turn to flourish, it's almost gone, except unless you're really already initiated into church life because of your past or because you're one of the rare people that maybe has had some sort of conversion experience and maybe goes to a more evangelical church, or you've got some faint echo of choral evensong, which I don't want to be sniffy about because they're amazing experiences, but nonetheless, this sort of sense that it can really shape your life, that discourse is fading very fast now.
Now you work as a therapist. How do you see? Yeah, I'm not obviously not asking you to talk about individual clients, but how do you see this disconnect in terms of the types of people that you spend a lot of time with and spend a lot of time listening to? Are many of your patients and clients just people from the general population, or? I mean, what are your re I mean, because I would assume, I mean, when you write a book like this and your perspectives are surely shaped by a lot of listening to how people are processing their lives and what they're struggling with and their lack of flourishing.
Yeah, and I mean, I've written the book very much trying to capture the inner dynamic that things like reading engage, seeing the world in a different way, a different, you know, adopting a different worldview, this evolution of consciousness idea, what that's like from the inside. And that comes very much from the psychotherapy practice. I mean, people come with different expectations, if you like, different hopes, some that very explicitly with Christian pasts, religious pasts, or they've listened to a lot of, I mean, I have, you know, people that have listened to a lot of YouTubes and sense that they know this thing called awakening or enlightenment kind of out there, you know, and they're wrestling with that. So sometimes it's quite explicit. Sometimes it's the normal kind of troubles that people face, anxiety, depression, those kind of things. I've worked in the NHS as well, which is the very explicitly clinical environment. Either for me, I think the primary thing is it's important for me to get a developing sense of where I think I'm coming from and where I'm rooted, you know. Otherwise, I think burnout is very common amongst psychotherapists. If you don't have a kind of sense of that, where your wellspring is located, and writing the book was really important for me in that way. But also it means that in my mind, if an engagement with someone feels like it's going in a more spiritual direction, you know, then I can kind of go there with them. I've got some resources to go there with them. You know, I'm very, very convinced that these things only really make a difference when you can absolutely own it yourself. So you're always trying to stay with the person and feel where they are, and see what next step might be possible to take. But also I think that, it's really important that kind of as a culture, we're trying to create the possibility for a connection to a life that's not just the life in our own heads. And although psychotherapy with Freud had a very skeptical approach to the spiritual, my sense is that in the 100 years or more since Freud, things have developed very substantially on from there. And many psychotherapists are very open to how, as Barfield put it, you know, consciousness is not just something tapped onto the rest of the world, but is the inside of the whole world. Yeah. And I think psychotherapy arose because there was a need to regain the kind of wisdom within a life that used to be, in the medieval Christian period, held by the religious houses, that kind of disappeared in this country almost overnight, within about 10 years of the Reformation, the dissolution of the monasteries, and it left a kind of a vacuum, and it's the kind of wisdom that's got to be lived to really be passed on. It's not like Newton's second law of motion, you know, which you can kind of read in a book. It's something that does come from within you.
Now, I watched your presence on Unbelievable with Malcolm Gait, and I thought that was a really wonderful conversation. And you also, I mean, you spoke on a. You and I spoke a little bit about it, about your story. And, you know, as what you said about therapists is also true of pastors. I mean, people imagine that pastors should somehow be these, we're seen by the roles that we play, and understanding that there's an inside to the roles that we play. And if the pastor doesn't have a living faith and doesn't have a continual, likely wrestling with many of the same things that the people that they are ministering to and with also wrestle with, there's a disconnect, and the pastor is not terribly helpful or useful for those around. So I'm curious, you know, it was interesting because Justin Brierley mentioned that you had spoken with him before, and I haven't dug up that episode, but between that episode and the subsequent conversation, obviously via this book, via Barfield, after Plato, you had a wonderful conversation with Michael, who I had spoken with before. I thought that was just a tremendous conversation. I thought you two went to a whole bunch of really helpful places, and it gave me a better understanding of how this book arose for you. How, and obviously I think part of your project for this book comes out of your experience of renewal with faith. Can you talk about how Jesus, how Christianity, how consciousness has changed for you in this journey?
I think you've got to have a sort of direct sense of things. And I think I can see now, as a kind of cradle Christian, you know, my family was Anglican, we went to church, and it was quite a natural thing for me to be ordained, for example. It wasn't difficult. And I was always interested in theology, you know, so doing the study was always straightforward. But I never really cracked the kind of direct experience, strangely enough, you know. It was always mediated by the church. I knew and loved, as it were, church rituals, church liturgies. I was always, you know, quite monastic in my inclination. So things like daily office and so on were part of where I was at. But I can see now that I was always a bit of one step removed. I never felt, which I know is a common experience, that, as it were, I had a sort of divine friend in Jesus. I never had that sense. And I also never really had the sense of God as a kind of person to relate to either. And so that kind of, what I think, in a way, looking back, that's what ran aground for me, that I kind of ran out of connection with the source of the Spirit, you might say. And then it wasn't until after I left being a curate, being an Anglican clergy person, and had a kind of breakdown, really, and through a combination both of therapy and also I discovered mindfulness. I went on a 3-year mindfulness training, which took you kind of step by step through a whole load of things, but realized that there was a felt presence of the divine that I could connect with, and that was very real to me. And so in a way, that was the beginning of being able to speak from a sense of actual participation, to use Barfield's term, in these things. And then when I, you know, got onto Barfield, it began to give a kind of backstory to the sense that I was having now, both in terms of Christianity, but also in terms of my own sort of experience of a kind of alienation and disconnect and so on, and how that was actually part and parcel of what he thought of the evolution of consciousness of our times. So that gave me, it sort of put three dimensions into this nascent kind of sense of divine awareness, you might say.
It's interesting when I listen to you, even though I would think some aspects of your faith are quite distinct from, let's say, certain forms of American evangelicalism that, especially in the 70s, you know, were categorized and articulated as a personal relationship with Jesus Christ. And what you just described is using some different words, but I think in some ways sort of maps and tracks with that movement. I've often referred to Chuck Colson, who in his book Born Again, you know, goes to his wife and says, you know, I've become a Christian. And his wife looks at him and says, but we're Episcopalians. What do you mean? We've go to church all the time. And of course, you know, Jimmy Carter goes on the cover of Time magazine as Born Again. And so this whole thing moves through the United States at that point. And it's interesting listening to you, you know, in similar terms, you know, obviously different, but also there's a sort of a mapping that's going together with that. I think that's interesting.
No, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, I was drawn to the more Anglo-Catholic side of things, also that was part of the monastic side. So, for example, I had a phase of doing quite a lot of silent prayer and trying to get into that, but it didn't really seem to work. It sort of exhausted me, it wasn't until I got with the Buddhists that could sort of show you silence a bit like how to ride a bike, the practicalities of it, and then some developed sense too of what goes on inside when you're trying to engage with these exercises, I just think that certainly in the Christian circles I knew, that inner kind of awareness, the wisdom has just kind of fallen away. Everyone knew, there were people that knew it was important, but the practical know-how as to how to do it just wasn't there. So quite heroically, kind of people struggled at it, but it's not sustainable.
It's very interesting, just looking over the landscape of these different Christian movements, because of course also in the United States, sort of spearheaded by Dallas Willard, there was the, you know, the Christian formation practice in the 70s as well. There was a renewed emphasis and focus of many, like Richard Foster, on meditation, the spirit of the disciplines. It's very interesting how these, you know, the in some ways distinct traditions, distinct practices, but perhaps all sort of in the service of a revitalization. So you like, you know, many others, so you learn some things from the Buddhists, but where does that, also in your interview with on Unbelievable, it sounds like you're still sort of homeless in a sense too, with respect to how to locate these things institutionally or communally.
Yeah, I do feel that a bit. I certainly do. I mean, I do a combo of both going to church and going to a place called the Buddhist Society, where they just have sitting practice. So it's like a communal sitting. It's nothing. There's no ritual attached, but it is nice to do that in a group. I mean, my tussle with the Church of England I know is that it very much defines itself in terms of its social engagement with English culture, say. Mm. And it, you know, very, very, it does that really, really well. There's a lot of civic engagement, you know, so we're not that far off Christmas now, and Southwark Cathedral, where I will go, they will have dozens and dozens of carol services, where people from all sorts of different companies and organizations will come in and do that. And they do that really well. You know, that does really give people something at this time of year. And then also the social justice side, which is very developed, you know, things like soup kitchens, food banks, and so on. That's quite a big part of what goes on in the UK now. I mean, the NHS is amazing. I've worked in the NHS, and there's over a million people, if you like, are doing Good Samaritan type stuff every day in the NHS out of a population of 65 million or something. So it's very, very well developed. But there's always a need for kind of the net that people inevitably fall through when you get big bureaucracies. So that's all very good, but it's very this worldly. It feels very kind of secular, actually. I've read that some people have written about the self-secularization of Christianity, which is when it flourishes in this kind of area, but forgets the more vertical dimensions. And, you know, in a way, because the Church of England certainly is going through an identity crisis, there's a huge risk that it devotes more and more energy to the things which it do seem to be going well, like the social engagement side of things. But at the same time, almost unawares, it's losing touch more and more and more with what I think of as its wellspring. And in fact, what could be its real USP, because there's lots of people that do good social engagement, and, you know, not least of which is the NHS. But what it feels to me like our culture really has lost a capacity to engage skillfully with is this spiritual dimension. And I think that's what Jesus meant by the kingdom. And that's why he kept going around saying, have they got eyes to see? Have they got ears to hear? And all that side of things. You know, we human beings need more than this world, even though we're in this world. Man shall not live by bread alone, et cetera, you know, you can quote away. But unless, I mean, it's much like you say, unless a pastor is kind of engaged with that element themselves in their own lives, even if they kind of know somewhere in the back of their mind it's important, it won't come through. And so the priests in the Church of England, unless they're engaged with that kind of personal development, the spiritual discernment of things themselves, inevitably it just doesn't have the vitality. And so, you know, when you're looking to be fed and develop yourself in that way, you have to search quite hard for a place where you can actually find that as the main priority.
It's, you know, it's interesting to listen to you talk about this, because obviously in America, I often hear the opposite complaint, which is that this large, let's say, evangelical church is so often so heavenly minded in the opinion of some, they're no earthly good. Although if you actually look at who in North America does put a great deal of time and money into helping drug addicts and serving the poor, you know, evangelical churches are very well represented in those spheres as well. And it seems that a good bit of the division happened with modernity in the skepticism with respect to, let's say, the world to come or the age to come. And so then this great emphasis on, well, we must bring about whatever goods can be had in life, and obviously goods understood as creature comforts, less anxiety, you know, fairly secular goods. Whatever goods can be had must be had within the secular frame. And it's very interesting. You know, I'm trying to get a sense of, when you say spiritual, especially in a highly secularized culture, and now let's say with sort of a Buddhist sensitivity, can you flesh that out in contrast to, let's say, the Church of England as you've described, or American evangelicalism, that are, you know, whatever, only what's good for the next world is important? So, because I want to get into some of that from your book, because some of the most interesting things that I was wrestling with in your book had a lot to do with Jesus and the kingdom, and in a sense, how these pieces fit together.
Yeah. I mean, maybe picking up on one part of what you said there, and then seeing where I can go with it. The whole kind of pie in the sky when you die approach, I think that has, it was probably quite a good critique at a certain time, but it also has led to a sort of, okay, so we must do something about this world. You know, we must, that's where we must engage with things. But I think that both ends of those poles, what they miss is actually what I think Jesus was on about the kingdom, which is, as I think it has been said, you know, there is another world and it is here. But the question is, how can we realign our sense of ourselves and our sense of being alive with the other world that's already here? You know, again, I think that one of the really powerful things that Jesus said that people at the time didn't get, and the early church didn't kind of really wrestled with, was, you know, not the kingdom will come, it'll be here, it'll be there, but no, the kingdom of God is within you. And so that's what I really mean by the spiritual, that, you know, we have our kind of, if you like, material reality, which we can touch, and we have our emotional, psychological reality, which we know very powerfully because it shapes our experience all day, every day. But as it were, within that, or behind that, or underneath that, is another possible experience, which is captured in biblical expressions like, for me, phrases like underneath of the everlasting arms. There's a kind of, it's a still sense of presence that is, if you like, life itself. And it's when you can live life from that sense of eternity, if in terms of, you know, so you're not just caught up in the rush of every day, but there's a capacity almost to step back and to see life from a much less rushed place. It's possible when you have kind of emotional ups and downs, which of course we all do, not to be completely identified with them, but to know that there's another side to you, which actually isn't really affected by those emotional ups and downs. It's right there with them, but it can keep you can, I mean, the practical side of it, in a way, is you can keep your mind about what's going on, so you don't get pushed and pulled in every direction. It's that sense. I think it's also a sense that our present times can be experienced from within, you know, what traditionally would be called salvation history, if you like, is a sense of God's unfolding in it, that is part of this world. But I think that when you experience that, then this world increasingly comes to be experienced as almost like the doorway to a much bigger reality. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I have a growing sense, really, to be sort of completely personal, this is kind of right at the cutting edge for me, but I do have a growing sense that our task in this life is to develop an awareness of these things at all levels, and to live as much as we can with a capacity to move between these different levels, from the material, the emotional, psychological, the spiritual, in a kind of a flow. And that somehow I feel will set us up well for what happens when we die. That we'll be able to, as it were, go into the next life with our eyes more open than we might have done otherwise. Hmm. I think this is what's in the stories and the accounts of the resurrection in the gospel. You know, the trouble that the disciples have with seeing the resurrected Jesus, I think, is sort of directly correlated to how much their eyes have opened, how much their ears can hear. And in a way, that's the challenge for us. How much of resurrected life do you see now? And the more you see now, I think, the more, I don't know quite what will happen after we die, of course, but somehow I feel that that's a big part of what we're called to do in this life, is to prepare for our passage into the next. But it's not that this life doesn't matter, because the way we prepare for the passage into the next is precisely how we live this life. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. If you see what I mean, it's a both and rather than an either or.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I was part of the, let me see if I can, I when I read it just a few minutes ago, I said I gotta put a bookmark in this, because it was when you're talking about Christ's miracles, and I've been preaching through the Gospel of Mark right now in a section of a good number of miracles, and I've really come to believe that part of the puzzle of figuring out the mind matter duality and a number of these things that are connected with it do have a lot to do with coming to terms with Jesus' miracles. And I think not in the sense of the modernist fundamentalist feud of the late 19th, early 20th century. Did they happen? Didn't they happen? Not that I don't think that, you know, I'm personally not skeptical at all about the nature of, you know, that Jesus multiplied loaves and fish, that Jesus stilled the storm. It's those, I'm not skeptical at all about those things, but this question that we're struggling to articulate about, you know, and again, I think Barfield is so helpful in this initial participation, this withdrawal from participation, and then the final participation. I think some of what C.S. Lewis understands the miracles to be in his book Miracles, which has been an important book for me, when he talks about the miracles of the old creation and the miracles of the new creation, really very much maps onto some of Barfield's final participation. And so what we see in the miracles are these expressions of final participation in the present age that Jesus manifests before you know, thousands of people in some cases. And so again, I've been preaching through these in the Gospel of Mark, and what amazes me so often is that we come out of the modernist fundamentalist frame with this idea that, oh, if I would only see a miracle, then I would believe, and then we imagine that somehow resolves everything. But when in fact you see the disciples, Jesus stills a storm in Mark chapter 4, and you know, they're shocked and in awe, and who is this man? And then he sends them across the lake, and they're rowing against, and then Jesus walks on the water, and you know, it's like, well, you still don't get it. It doesn't matter. And in fact, right in the Gospel of Mark, it says, you know, they didn't understand the loaves because of, you know, their hearts were hardened, which nobody in the New Testament wants that to be said of them in pharaohic terms. But this way that Jesus manifests this final participation in that the winds and the waves obey him, the challenge of a hungry crowd and not enough money. And Jesus tells his disciples, you give them something to eat. And they're, you know, what do you mean give them something to eat? And, you know, he said, well, go find what you got, you know, 5 loaves and 2 fish and bring them to me. He looks up to heaven, he breaks the bread, and, you know, there are 12 baskets left over. And so these perennial challenges that we have to try to not just understand, articulate, but live within the world as it is. And then, of course, with the resurrection, I think C.S. Lewis is absolutely right, and I think the book of Colossians hits this, that the resurrection isn't just, oh, one additional miracle in line of the other, but the resurrection is actually the door into what the new, what the next dispensation will be, you know, the life of the age to come. So for me, these miracles of Jesus that we have this side distraction over here, did they or didn't they happen, completely misses the insight that the miracles should afford as to what happens when all of the layers are put back together. So I couldn't find the quote in your book, but I was curious as to how that, you know, how those miracles play to your view of Barfield and your book.
Yeah, I mean, I remember you made this comment about C.S. Lewis' book Miracles and Barfield's Final Proposition before, and that I thought, oh yes. I mean, more. I think what happened to me is that miracles have just become less of an issue. You know, back in the days when I was doing my physics degree, you know, they were, and you know, you could read these apologists that try to talk about the suspension of the laws of nature or something like that, you know, and it wasn't very satisfactory. But I think once I started getting into mental health particularly, you start to realize that, well, a couple of things really. One is that you're waiting on something often in mental health. You know, this is no secret in psychiatry. You know, a drug may help, it may not, but it's not really tremendously successful. And you only have to work on a mental health ward for a short while to start hearing psychiatrists say things like, well, we could try this. I sometimes get good results with that. You realize that you're just trying to provide a container for something else to happen. And then, and to sort of discern it and work with it. But that started putting me directly in touch with a side of life that the purely physicalist approach can't really accommodate at all. And then also, you know, what Jung famously called synchronicities and so on, they start to occur. So things become meaningful, you know, people have dreams and coincidences occur, whatever it might be. And you start to realize that you're engaging with a dimension of life where this isn't, it's not that they happen all day, every day, but it's also not that, as it were, reality has somehow been snapped in order that these can be fitted in. It's much more that you're engaging with a different level of reality and you start to become more conscious of them. Another thing that happened was when I was trying to get to grips with Owen Barfield's original participation, I read quite a lot about encounters with indigenous people, because I had the idea that, you know, maybe they still live in a kind of original participation. And it seems to me that they do. And it's very common for, say, Christian missionaries to go to fairly isolated tribes and to witness the tribe seeing spirits, you know, collectively, en masse. And you can dismiss it as superstition, of course, but it seems to me that these people are very savvy about their environments. That's how they survive, you know. They're not stupid. They see things, quite literally, I think, which you and I just wouldn't see. And so these kind of two things, they don't get me to Jesus walking on the water and stilling the storm, but they got me just a step further to realizing that I find it completely understandable that a figure like Jesus would be living with direct contact with levels of reality that enabled these things to kind of happen around him. You know, exceptional things do happen, but people have paranormal experiences and so on all the time. They're random, they're chaotic, they can be disturbing, they don't know what to make of them. But someone who was living with a full sense of contact with those many layers of reality, I think that those things would not only happen, but they'd also be able to make something of them and to be, as you were, aligned with them. So that, it's not so much that I've had to reconcile miracles and reality, it's as if you like, my sense of reality has gradually got bigger.
Yeah. Well, and I very much appreciate what you say, because as a pastor too, you, when you're just dealing with people being themselves, you know, I found part of what secularism has done is a mass shaming of people and a silencing of people to speak naturally about the experiences that they have. And so as a pastor, you very quickly realize that people in polite company will not tell stories that are sometimes their most meaningful, because they will be shamed, they will lose status, because they'll tell a story that can't easily be explained in a sort of scientistic framework. And so, you know, it strikes me also that for most of the history of the New Testament, the miracles were seen in missionary efforts as validations for the authority of Jesus and the Gospels themselves. And of course, with the advent of modernity, that situation gets reversed amongst at least people who have been sufficiently impressed by the fruits of modernity and sufficiently enculturated by the habits of modern speech. Yet that's a fairly limited bubble within human history, one that, as is true of most bubbles, we tend to impress ourselves with. So, but again, these, when I'm talking to people about Barfield and I'm trying to get my, and I'm trying to articulate where Barfield is going with this, I think the language in the way it's heard right now, let's say, of an evolution of consciousness, because of the particular communities and the language habits of those communities, that phrase gets framed in a certain way, which tends to be a bit Gnostic-y. That okay, so we've got the mind matter duality, and what we'd really like to see is people derive more enjoyment and a sense of satisfaction from life from the mind, the story sphere, the mind aspect, and then the materiality aspect is therefore diminished and demoted. Whereas what we find in Jesus is this radical integration of the world, which is what I sense in Barfield, and how Barfield then is able to address the meaning crisis. Because I just had a conversation, I don't know whose conversation I'm going to post tomorrow, yours or the one I just had, with an individual with whom and he and I are entering into a certain degree of debate, where on one hand he expressed his skepticism as to whether or not Christianity offers resources to offer resources to address the challenges that we face in our contemporary society. But the longer we talk, the more I hear a nihilism that basically sees the world as dead and mind as a sometimes inconvenient byproduct of this great capacity that we've developed in a Darwinian frame for survival, and which leads into this full-blown nihilism, which I think Barfield in some of his essays clearly saw coming. And so the initial participation is not a Gnostic retreat from apples and freshly baked bread and the glory that the book of Isaiah says God has shot the world through with. And I think that's part of why I see Barfield as so helpful for affording these glimpses of glory and promises that we won't just be observers of glory, but participate in the production of glory, which is in fact what we were made for.
Yes, I mean, we've got our sort of modern day prophets, and Barfield would particularly point us to the Romantic poets, but also the metaphysical poets. I think figures like William Blake, Thomas Traherne have been very important to me, and it seems to me that what they indicate is that the direction of travel is to see more and more and more of material reality as alive, as having living qualities, and in some ways, I think modern Christianity has itself got very Gnostic, because in a way, what it's done is it's kind of stripped out the spiritual ecology, which was part and parcel, say, of medieval Christianity. You know, it knows that the human matters, it knows that God, the Trinity, matters, but there's almost nothing in between now. In a lot of Christianity. And so, although it probably wouldn't say the cosmos is a dead machine turning over like scientific materialism would, it sort of defaults to that nonetheless. I think that part of the task now is to revive our perception, our participation in the rich kind of spiritual ecology that many Christian writers wrote about. And it's precisely in the world. As Andrew Marvel puts it, one of the metaphysical poets in his nice poem, The Garden, the curious peach, is participating in the divine vision too. And it's by contemplating the apples and the curious peach, as you put it, that the divine vision comes to you. Yes, with this nice extra twist there, which you give it there about that there's a meaning, I think, with the withdrawal, which is that our participation can be, our becoming co-workers can be enhanced. And that's also what I like about Barfield, is it's not a council of despair in that sense either. It's not nihilistic either in that way. There's actually a meaning to our sense of disengagement in order that our sense of who we are as individuals can sort of gain from that crisis, really, in order that we can reparticipate in a new way, a fuller way.
Right, right. Have you read Lewis's The Discarded Image?
Yes, yeah, yeah.
And because when I read that just recently, and, you know, after having read some Barfield and talking to you about Barfield, you know, it struck me how much Barfield I heard in that book as well. And so Lewis, of course, laments the loss at the end of The Discarded Image. He laments the loss of this unified worldview, medieval worldview based in the classic worldview that just afforded meaning in so many helpful ways to sufferers people who suffered, you know, the common indignities of humanity throughout the Middle Ages, and that image then gets discarded. And this, you know, in conversations that I have sometimes with Roman Catholic and especially Orthodox Christians, who in some ways, you know, very much long for I think Orthodoxy in sort of its renaissance it's seeing in the United States now is really an attempt at getting back to original participation. And you know, the Protestant Reformation was this, you know, grand tragedy that followed the tragedy of the division of the church between Greek and Latin. Yet none of us are retreating back to a hovel in the woods, or at least few of us, and not bringing cell phones and batteries and knowledge of germs and sanitation. But yet, so I very much agree that Barfield's helpful in even in the withdrawal from participation. That you can see, so the missionaries find the tribe, and for, you know, for a long time, we've recognized that the secularizing influence that the missionaries, that the Western colonial missionaries had on these peoples, and the, you know, some of what was lost by that secularization, and the deep secularization that the church now has, which gets split into either, at least in the United States, the mainline church, which, oh, we're trying to perfect this world, and the evangelical church, which sometimes is, well, we're just all, you know, trying to get people on the boat into the next world. And again, I think Barfield has the potential for offering a hope, an image of resolution for this, and giving us images and pointers to how we might read the Bible in a way that helps us not lose the benefits of this middle passage of a withdrawal from participation, but yet bring it together in resolution, in a sense of final participation. And there are so many. This week I'm preaching on Jesus talking. It's such a fascinating passage. After these passages of the miracles, the Pharisees and the teachers of the law come to Jesus and complain that his disciples are not properly washing, the ceremonial washing, and so they're taking in defilement. And Jesus makes this move where he says, defilement doesn't come from the outside in, defilement comes from the inside out. And now reading that after knowing some Barfield, it's like, oh my, you know, this movement that Jesus is making, and this and I know Luther doesn't always get too kind a treatment, and some of that is rightfully deserved, but some of what happens in the Reformation is also this movement that Luther makes, the psychologizing, which in some ways accentuates the problem of withdrawal from participation, but also, you know, is right there sort of in a line. If Luther is reading Jesus talking to the scribes and Pharisees, it's not a big jump that Luther has to make in terms of Luther addressing some of the practices of medieval Catholicism in the ways that they sort of practiced a sort of initial participation in the sacramental system that they worked with.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that my sense of it, and you probably know this a lot more about this than me, but Luther certainly, maybe Calvin too, is that they reproblematized the individual struggle with the external authorities, and you know, and it's a messy business. I mean, it's a real struggle. It's not just a bit of dotting I's and crossing T's. It is a kind of crisis and a collapse, which is why the Reformation, I think, was bloody. But the legacy for us now is, as it were, if it's not quite in the Bible, it's not quite in the world, it's not, you know, we've got to kind of put these things all together and bring ourselves fully into engagement with these things. And then, as you say, when Jesus making these apparently, you know, slightly odd, but apparently Enoch's comments about it's not what comes from without, but what comes from within that defiles. Suddenly you realize that in that very moment, he is seeing the switch of consciousness. He's seeing the evolution of consciousness. They're massively significant moments. Yeah, good luck with that one.
Well, there were the Pharisees and the scribes very much saw them as massively significant. And it's,
yeah, that's true, yeah.
It's exactly these kinds of things that Jesus said which would bring about his death, because they understood that he was dismantling this system, that he was dismantling, dismantling their religion, which, and so, you know, he's dismantling, say, okay, well, it's not the, you know, it's not this defilement. And it's like, well, okay, so Jesus, and on one hand, we can give him some cover because they're clearly referring to the tradition of the elders, which hedges the Torah. But in Jesus making this comment, he is engaging the entire Mosaic system. And the authors of the Gospel of Mark know this because they put a parenthetical comment that basically says, well, you see, this is why eating anything is okay. And it's like, whoa, you know, you have just set up the tremendous conflict that will play out in the very early church between people who are saying we are the true inheritors of Moses versus those who are saying, hey, wait a minute, you ought not to eat these kinds of meat and you ought to practice. And so you very much have these two systems set up to conflict each other. And Jesus comes on top of them and says, you interpret Moses through me now. And you can very much understand why a good number of people are going to say, oh, really? And where, of course, the disciples will need a great deal of evidence to, okay, they're impressed with Jesus and they want to follow him, but then he's killed. And if that, in fact, is the end of the story, well, why have this massive civil war within the Jewish, you know, the diaspora Jewish nation, if Jesus was just making stuff up and he was actually killed by the Romans and he didn't finally appear to his disciples in such a convincing way that they began to die at either the hands of the Romans or at the hands of their fellow Jewish people. So, I mean, there's a ton in this that I think Barfield, with this nice three simple movement, I think illuminates. And then when you see the movements of this participation and you go back to the Bible, you say, oh my, this is really lighting up some passages that we had sort of, you know, as Protestants, you'd read that and say, oh, okay, so, well, this is why Reformed Christians would eat sausage on Friday to annoy their Catholics. And so then we set up these facile arguments. We Protestants are on Jesus' side, and you Catholics with your transubstantiation are over there. Oh, no, it's nowhere near that simple. And what we see actually is this continual return to these transactional moments. And I think, yeah, again, I evolution of consciousness, yeah, but what on earth do we mean by that? Because this move that Jesus makes in this passage, this is, I think Barfield nicely frames and says, there is something really important about the trajectory of human history with respect to mind and matter and how these two things are understood, and this telos that he gives us that says they need to be integrated. And what we see in Jesus Christ, I think in his miracles and resurrection, is revelation in terms of that integration. We, however, are struggling to not, you know, we, you know, Jesus did it. We're just trying to understand it in some ways and then lean and live into it.
Yeah, I mean, this, what you're talking there, it's making me think of an area that was quite a discovery for me when I was reading the book, which is the research that's been done on the intertestamental period. Because when I did my theology back in the late 1980s, I don't really remember thinking much about Hellenistic Judaism. We kind of leapt from, you know, very rich Old Testament scholarship into rich New Testament scholarship. But very basic things we never ask, like, how come the New Testament's full of synagogues when there's not a single synagogue in the Old Testament? And then there was also that nice naive question about, you know, why did Jesus come in roughly 0 AD?
When the time was fully, how was it fully? When we had this 400 years of sort of silence, especially if you're a Protestant in between.
Yeah. So now, having read much more about this intertestamental period and the work, which I think is quite relatively new, really trying to flesh that out, looking at a lot of apocryphal material, just looking at the history, this kind of thing, is that I think that Hellenistic Judaism, you know, the world was becoming a very troubled place. It's a time of just endless trouble within Judaism, Judaism and the Greeks, and then Judaism and the Romans. But it's also, you do get a sense, thinking more spiritually about it, that the world was becoming a much thinner place. That the sense that people had of the distance between, you know, this world and the next, or the world now and the world to come, with particularly apocalyptic expectations. You know, I think that there was a sense of proximity there, and maybe that's a bit like the dualisms of now, you know, where mind and matter feel so, you know, in one worldview that you can occupy, feel so far apart. You can sort of segue into another worldview, which for me has been around mental health, where mind and matter actually feel much, much more intertwined. It's much harder to say what's one and what's the other. And it's when you kind of enter that that kind of zone that, as it were, the Kairos moment can start to happen, and a new perception of things can start to form. So I see some analogy somehow between, you know, the intertestamental period and now. You know, it's not for nothing, as I think we said with Justin Briley, it's not for nothing that consciousness is like the grit in the materialist shell that won't give up. You know, that's where these worlds start to come close to one another again, and what you thought had been separate maybe isn't quite so separate after all. I listened to your lovely conversation, your commentary on Roger Penrose's conversation with William Lane Craig, isn't it?
Yes.
And I've interviewed Roger Penrose a few times myself, because I do writing in science and religion, and I remember one time he said to me, do you know, sometimes when I turn a light on, I realized that the room's been filled with eternity. And I said, what do you mean? And he says, well, I filled the room with photons, and they travel at the speed of light, which means they don't experience time. You know, so the room is sort of filled with eternity. And I think that, I always remember it, because for me, that was like him coming close to, you know, his three worlds. Actually, that's just like a holding model. But really what I think I wonder whether he gets glimpses of is something that transcends that altogether, actually.
Yeah.
And that's really the direction of travel. It's not to try and reckon, it's not really to decide, is the mental bigger than the mathematical, is bigger than the material, whatever, you know. No, it's to hold the tension and then see what, as it were, explodes altogether and transcends it altogether.
Oh, interesting. What a great line. Well, and what's so amazing to me, you know, again, I've been, you know, as I so love my job, because they pay me to study the Bible. What a wonderful life I have. But, you know, when you begin to realize, you know, not only does Jesus manifest this initial participation in the miracles, but his whole life then and death is this renegotiating of what it means to be anointed, which is Messiah and Christ. And the Gospels are really this struggle between world saving projects. Of the Romans have their Roman way. Obviously the Pharisees and the teachers of the law, and even the disciples, are working their own projects. And Jesus, you know, okay, well, everybody understands the project that almost all of them are working. You gather a big army, you get them weapons, you mobilize them, you try to win battles, you take cities, you, one way or another, you, by virtue of the sword, you conquer the world. And Jesus comes at it in a remarkably different way by saying, well, I will conquer the world by you killing me. And of course, when we hear that, we think, no, that's, getting killed is the definition of losing. And And Jesus, of course, loses on the cross, which is what everyone sees. It gets inverted in the New Testament and says, no, this is actually resolving the grand story of humanity. And then he rises and shows his disciples, but doesn't stop by Pontius Pilate or Herod to say, you know, how do you like me now? Doesn't do that, which one would think, well, that would, but no, that's quite clearly moving back into the script of the world. And then, of course, you know, a couple, you know, 300 years later, a Roman emperor will, you know, place a cross on his standard and conquer in that name, which of course has its own twists involved. But again, you talk about an evolution of consciousness. There are real reasons why Jesus just completely overturns history by doing something which seems so utterly common and catastrophic, being one of the thousands of people that the Romans crucified during their reigns. And you know, we don't have a sufficient respect for what how this has all changed the world. And so again, I think Barfield's work nicely illuminates some of the mysteries that are going on there that we are insufficiently respectful of.
Yeah, I mean, it takes me to what I sort of feel is the real gift of Christianity to the world in a way, which is making kind of crystal clear, if you like, first of all, in the person of Jesus and the notion of incarnation. But then I think this is something which can become everyone's experience, at least in principle, is that, as it were, my I am rests in the divine I am in some way. And that when, as it were, the physical body does pass away, is, you know, killed, that's not the end of Jesus originally, and that's not the end of us either. And it becomes both, death becomes both the moment at the end of life, of course. But I think also that, you know, the reason why Paul can start talking about crucifying every day and taking up his cross every day and so on is that he realizes that the small deaths of the small I am every day open up more and more onto the divine I am. So he can eventually start saying things like, you know, the mind of Christ is within me. It's not no longer I that live, but Christ live within me, and so on. I mean, that's what you see that quite nicely, actually. You see this evolution of consciousness in Paul's letters, even, where he gradually, it's partly because he's speaking to different audiences and responding to different requests. You know, they're not systematic, but I think you can sort of track a growing, what's sometimes called the mystical Paul, as he himself too realizes that what had happened climactically at the end of Jesus's life, but also I think had been happening through, can be the same pattern for his own life. And it doesn't just mean he might be martyred, you know, given that he actually was, but that there's something about the dying every day, the inner sacrifice, the inner offering, that becomes so absolutely crucial. He realizes that as well. And I kind of feel like now that part of the divine wisdom of having the cross at the center of Christianity is that it means that at the end of the day, you can't ignore that. That is the crucial dynamic. It's you know, because sometimes one of the criticisms she's made, and maybe this is what you mean by being a bit gnosticky, that as if this reading of Christianity is just kind of sailing off into heavenly bliss. You know, it's like all resurrection and no crucifixion. But I think it, you know, Christianity really does nail that it's the both and. It's only when that, you know, that path is fully followed. As I try and put it in the book, you know, it's because Jesus really is fully human to the point of death that he can fully mirror and be transparent to the divine. It's like the more human you are, the more that happens, not the less human you are, the more that happens. I think that's, and I think this then gets picked up in different religions, actually, even. I mean, this is a bit of an ongoing project for me. You know, my understanding is that what we now think of as Judaism, rabbinic Judaism particularly, responded to the moment in a different way. The law became what has been called, I think, everyday mysticism. So that the law makes you attend to every moment and, as it were, feel the divine in every moment. So I think this is a different response to the times, which I quite like seeing how they can complement each other now. Because in a way, you know, if Christianity has got the tendency to think about pie in the sky when you die, and Judaism now will say, no, it's kind of like, what's the next festival? That's what really matters. And how does that shape the seasons and so on? And this idea that the other world that's here, you know, that's one way of understanding that. I once asked a friend of mine who's a very strict Jew, I said, you know, why don't you use a lift on the Sabbath? It seems a bit extreme. You know, I can press the button, but you can't. What's the point of that? And he said, look, you know, if it was all rational, then these rules wouldn't take me anywhere else. They would just keep me in the rational world with everyone else, you know. Mm. And the whole point is that it's constantly edging you towards a different perception of things. So some sort of, in a way, I feel that, you know, if Judaism might be reminding us of some of that as Christians now. It was true at the time that man was made for this, Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. But there's something about maybe the Sabbath that we need to take on board again now, you might say.
Well, and I think that's right. I think the participation of the Mosaic Law was intended to create a rich contextual environment for God's people, where God was, you know, where God's created order, which you see obviously manifest in Genesis 1, where God's created order is just lights up everything in their world. And we, you know, we tend to look back on it as this burden, but talk to anyone who is religious about going to the gym. Well, yeah, it's a burden, but it's also liberation. And so I think that was built into the law, which then, you know, makes Jesus pivot then all the more interesting, because I think the pivot, you know, I'm sort of showing my third use of the law, Calvinism here. I think Jesus' pivot then is to continue to recalibrate this balance that it has. That's right. The Moses spoke of me because the restrictions were supposed to shine with my order, but that order can too quickly become a tyranny, and you have to understand that the law was an icon, not an idol. And so then Jesus, I think, makes that move there, that an idol is the thing which now the manifestation of the law becomes at the top of their hierarchy and the thing that they worship, instead of an icon, which should have been the thing that they see God through. But that seeing God through then reorients their hierarchy, so they understand that you ought not to, you know, segregate your goods so you can impoverish your parents, imagining that God is now giving permission to this, when you ought to understand that the parents are in fact higher than the goods that you are withholding from them in terms of God's list of priorities. So,
I mean, you know, when you say that, this is one of my bugbears about the way the parables in Christianity are read now. Maybe there's a parallel here. You know, they have been read as this worldly moral tales. You know, so the Good Samaritan is about being a good Samaritan. In a way, they've ceased to function in the way that Barfield develops and others too, but I certainly got it from him. That no, these are a kind of stories that are supposed to twist and turn inside you in order that a completely different perception, a different energy almost of life can be channeled to you. You know, so the significance of the Good Samaritan isn't that he did the good work to the chap in the ditch, although that was, you know, good that he did it, but that he was free to do it. And, you know, that was the difference between him and the other two. And if you can attend to that quality in the parables, then I think the divine light can start to shine back through them again. And it's why I think a lot of the parables just aren't moral at all. if you know, they're either immoral or amoral. And but if you try and attend to them, as you know, Barfield's very clear about this, that the way to perceive this new life is to focus on the felt side of it, to focus on the energy. You know, so that's why he was into poetry. You destroy a poem if you try and sort of nail its meaning. But a poem lives when the feeling of it keeps channeling and speaking to you. And I think that parables are very much like that. You know, I don't know, we had in church the other week the parable of the unjust steward, you know, who goes around and says, "Look, I'll cut your debts," when he thinks he's going to lose his job. You know, so what's that about? And then he gets praised for it. But there's something about he's living on the edge, living in the moment. When you start to sort of almost admire him, the kind of quality of edginess, then I sort of had a felt sense of there's an energy there that maybe speaks of the kingdom. You know, he's literally on an edge. That's part of the value of the story, I guess. He's sort of being kind of doing, he feels that his life's at stake, you know, nothing less than his life's at stake. You know, the kind of the slight mania of the parable almost. I think Jesus is really trying to say, look, there's something, even though this story seems completely immoral, and there's something about the quality of the narrative there, that if you can just allow that to fall on you, then that can become an energy that you can use as well, that takes you into different appreciation of life. Something like that, anyway.
That's one of my favorite parables. And I don't know, do you know who Kenneth Bailey is?
No, I don't know.
Kenneth Bailey is he's a New Testament scholar who for years taught in Lebanon. And there's a number of books of his treatment of the parables. And I particularly like his treatment of that parable. I've used it sometimes and people hate it. I won't go into it right now. But I very much agree that the parables and the miracles, I think, speak in the same way, in that you're very right that the parables are not mere moral stories, because, you know, both Luke 15 has the parable of the lost coin and the lost sheep and then the lost son. And anyone who, you know, not particularly with the coin, because coins don't wander off, but any good shepherd who would read the parable of the lost sheep would stop and say, now that's completely irresponsible to risk the 99 to go look for the one. And any moralist who would look at the behavior of the younger son, just as the older brother does, he presents the moral voice in the story, and Jesus ends the parable, leaving us wondering not whether the disobedient son, who, as the story ends, is wonderfully ensconced in the party, which for Jesus, if you read the Gospel of Luke, the party is the kingdom of heaven, and the outer darkness, the land far off, is hell. You know, we leave the parable wondering if the elder brother will make it to the party, because the elder brother doesn't want to go. And that then goes into the parable of the crooked steward, which is one of my favorite parables, because people read that parable and I watch interpreters twist themselves all kinds of different ways to derive a moral out of it, and you just can't. And I think that is a part of the purpose of the parable. But I think, I mean, Jesus' miracles, I believe, are actually parables in action. That is the role that they play, in that he illuminates the kingdom of God. Well, how is turning, you know, how many, I've calculated it before, you know, the amount of water that Jesus turns to wine at the wedding at Cana. It's an astounding amount of wine. and this is for people who have already had a good amount to drink. And you say, well, why would he do such a thing? And well, it's a parable. Well, is it a moral lesson? No, goodness, it's not a moral lesson. It's a lesson that is intended. And he keeps it a complete secret. The lovely thing of the miracle of Cana is apparently only the servants who have listened to Jesus know what happened. So the slaves understand, and the partiers and the masters have no idea. And what's so amazing about the Gospels is that they're full of these ambiguities and these these things that just completely misalign our sense of how things ought to be. So,
yeah, I mean, and I love the first miracle in John. Again, Barfield helped me understand a detail in that story, which always troubled me, which is when Jesus says to his mother, "Woman, what have you got to do with me?" You know, and people say, "Oh, you know, that's just the way you address the woman," or something like this. You know, they make all these kind of excuses. But then Barfield got me thinking about Deuteronomy, where Deuteronomy is really strong that you need to break those old relationships to family. You know, if your brother tells you what to do, stone your brother, it says in Deuteronomy. And I think this is a kind of, this is another sort of a kind of like imaginative wrestle that goes on to propel you into a different dispensation. And so I think when Jesus says to Mary's mother, "Woman, what have you got to do with me?" He's sort of saying, look, this is part of the new, what's about to happen is part of the new dispensation as well. To sort of alert you, as it were, that not just being part of the tribe, being part of the family, part of original participation, to use Barfield's phrase, that comment would have alerted them to that, that something new is about to happen, because it echoes the Deuteronomic way of thinking about the family. You know, that's in Jeremiah as well. I think the lovely expression about, you know, the parents will taste bitter herbs, but the children's teeth won't be on edge, or whatever. I can't remember the analogy there, but yeah. Anyway, yeah. That, again, a lot of these details, which, as you say, some people can try and sort of smooth out or pretend aren't really there. When you see it in terms of this quantum leap, that almost in every, if it sometimes feels like almost in every phrase is trying to sort of like nudge you towards.
Yeah.
It's really helpful.
Yeah. Well, I've enjoyed this, Mark. I don't know if you have anything else you'd like to. We've gone on for a little over an hour, so.
Yeah, no, it's great to. I mean, I'm really pleased that we've talked about, you know, both the, I don't know, mind matter problems, the miracles, you know, what Jesus was really driving at, you know, where we're at now. It heartens me that, you know, you too, as it were, feel that this is about trying to shift consciousness to see another world that's already here. Because I do feel very, very powerfully, you know, my like mission with Barfield, I feel this is what he's told me, and I want to try and carry it on, is to say, I think this is really where it's at with Christianity now. And I hope it's exciting for people. Yeah, I hope, you know, there's a tremendous promise there. And I feel like it chimes a lot with, you know, the people certainly I come across who are interested in awakening, new consciousness, enlightenment. You know, I think that Christianity can really address that head on and embrace that movement, which I think is in the air, certainly as I see it. You know, it is the sort of the zeitgeist. It is where the spirit's at, I think. It is where God's mission's at now, you might say. And so to try and align with that, with the richness of what Christianity has to bring, feels to me to be, you know, the way to go.
Well, I think, you know, again, I appreciate, you know, I appreciate what you're doing to bring Barfield back into the conversation. And I very much agree that his, you know, perhaps his time has come in some ways, more than in his life. But I, you know, Jesus says that we will do greater things than some of what he has done. And that's always an interesting thing to discern, exactly what aspects and frame we might imagine that in. But I see real hope and realization in Barfield's pointing us to final participation that can motivate us and give us hope and a vision for what Christ in us can do in our lives and in the life of the age to come, which I think, again, in a Pauline perspective, is always now and not yet. I mean, the New Testament always places us at the in the end times, and you're like, well, 2,000 years seems like kind of a long end time, but that we're, you know, the present evil age with the resurrection of Christ has been diminishing, and the life of the age to come has begun in the resurrection, and so we're in this middle phase, and so we are continuing to wrestle with this withdrawal from participation, hopefully fruitfully, but also being pointed to a final participation where the parables and the miracles of Jesus not only illuminate the common things of our life, but begin to transform, continue to transform us and I hope Christ's church in both a cruciform and a resurrected way. So, you know, as a minister, that's my vocation to live this, to point to this, to encourage this, and to help people believe that, you know, it might sound Pentecostal of me, but my, perhaps where I differ from the Pentecostals is not that I believe miracles still happen, but that miracles always happen in the way that Jesus, miracles are for how Jesus used them, as are the parables. And I think Barfield is a tremendous addition to this conversation, because he helps us grapple with the challenges of this modern withdrawal from participation that at some point will be moved beyond. So
I completely agree. Yeah.
So thank you, Mark. And
thank you. Really appreciated it. Yeah.
And I've enjoyed this, and I'm sure we'll talk again. So keep doing your work and keep doing interviews. Again, I had to make a decision whether or not to post third party content, but that conversation you did with Michael, I'm going to put a link to it, because I thought you two covered a ton of really helpful stuff and really shed some light on your journey. And I thought it was just a wonderful conversation. I'd love more people to see it. So,
yeah, well, thank you for all that you do as well, because, you know, I discovered you when I was Googling around Barfield, and you were already onto him. And so it's a very nice thing, feeling for me to feel, to be part of something that is bubbling up and an engagement as well. So thank you.
All right. Well, have a good evening.
You too.
Okay. Cheers. Bye-bye.